So today we get to start a brand new series, which I'm really excited about. We're starting a brand new series on the Book of Ruth. And if you've ever read the Book of Ruth, it's a very unassuming book, but it is a really great book. It's a book full of significance and meaning, and it's absolutely fascinating. For being historical literature, for being written such a long time ago and in a completely different way that we would write a story now, it has all of the components of a great story to it. It has all of the things that we are looking for in our Western 21st culture for a good story. The Book of Ruth has those elements. But what makes the Book of Ruth remarkable isn't how well it is written, but what is written. It's an incredibly ordinary story about ordinary people going about their ordinary lives. But the background, working in the background, in the mundane and in the ordinary, God is at work accomplishing his extraordinary purposes. In our culture, we kind of have an obsession with greatness, don't we? You know, after all, it's not the ordinary stories that normally get told. Right, the ordinary stories quite often don't get heard. We want to be inspired. We want to hear the great stories. We want to hear the stories about battles and conquests and victory and failure and defeat. We want to hear those really exciting stories. But the droning mantra of our culture tells us that the only way to live a life of meaning is to achieve greatness. You see, as humans, each and every single one of us has a deep need, not even a desire, a deep need in our hearts for significance, for meaning. And our culture tells us the way to achieve significance, the way to achieve meaning is through greatness. There's a popular rock band by the name of AWOL Nation. And they wrote a song last year, and it's playing on the radio quite frequently, so you may have heard it. And it's a little bit of a satire on our culture right now, but I find that it sometimes satire speaks the loudest truth, doesn't it? And it really puts its pulse on our culture right now. And I'm going to read just some of the lyrics to you. It says, "I'm hardly perfect, I'm barely good, just shy of greatness. I'm heavy metal, I'm hollow wood, just shy of patience. Me, I want to walk a little bit taller. Me, I want to feel a little bit stronger. Me, I want to think a little bit smarter. Said, I just want to be the best. I just want to be the best." See, ordinary is not enough today. Right? Ordinary is not enough. That's what our culture tells us. But to think or to expect, which is so often what we do of our youth and our children, that everyone is the best or the greatest, is absolute nonsense. By its very definition, the term the best or the greatest is an exclusive term. Not everyone can be the best. My generation and the generation following us have been bombarded with this mantra, and it might sound familiar to you. You know, follow your dreams, shoot for the stars, find your passion. You can be anything that you want to be. And that sounds awesome, doesn't it? That sounds great. Like who doesn't want to encourage their children? Who doesn't want to say, hey, you know what? You can accomplish something. You are worth something. You can make a difference in this world. Like, those are exciting things to say. You know, no one would argue that we shouldn't encourage our children. But did you know that experts are actually finding, as the youth are emerging, and especially in my generation, that this mantra is actually having an opposite effect? It's actually not engaging people into action. Instead, it's crippling them with inaction, with anxiety and pressure. You see, for a young person who wants to become, say, a plumber, they can't be a plumber. It's that would be considered settling, right? They might want to be a plumber. They might even be a good plumber. But that's not reaching for the stars. That's not following your passion. That's not pursuing your dreams. And so what we have is we have all kinds of college and university students who are dropping out and living with their parents well into their 30s because they haven't found their passion yet. They haven't found their one thing that they need to find. Right? And so this pressure is actually crippling. It's actually not making people feel extraordinary. It's making them feel overwhelmingly ordinary. But the pressure to stand out doesn't just plague our youth, right? Absentee fathers who worked on holidays and weekends and late every night just to climb the corporate ladder, right? Because so that they could be the best at what they were doing, right? They've been around for as long as we can remember. Today, moms have to make sure that their children are gluten-free, free-range, non-GMO fed, have the best birthday parties, and they have to look good while doing all of that. Ordinary is not good enough today. And this is what makes the book of Ruth so interesting and so compelling today, is that even when we look at the Bible, you know, it's full of great stories. It's full of the stories of the great heroes of our faith, stories of God's miraculous intervention. It's stories of failure and triumph, wars and conquests. But Ruth is different. Ruth focuses, it zooms in and brings into perspective the ordinary, on how God is working in the invisible, mundane, and ordinary of everyday life. And why is this important? Why is the book of Ruth in the Bible? I think one of the great ways that it speaks to our culture right now is that for all the hype, for all the pressure, I think most of us probably feel pretty ordinary. If we're really honest with ourselves, I think most people, not everyone, but most people probably feel pretty ordinary. And we have to ask ourselves, where do the average and the ordinary fit into God's redemptive plan? Where do we fit into his story? I remember growing up in church as a kid, and preachers would come, and they would talk about how God saved life, which as a young man sounded really exciting, you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, right? That God saved them from the story, and now they're a great preacher, right? They had a great story. It was inspiring, and it was just so compelling. And I almost wanted to go out and sin so I could have a great story about how God redeemed me, you know? It almost was having the opposite effect. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm just an unassuming homeschooler. I'm kind of in the middle of my family somewhere, like I was the youngest, and then the middle, and then we added more kids, and I'm just kind of in there somewhere. You know, and it's I just felt like an average Joe. I've been waiting all week for that moment. My sermon this morning is entitled Extraordinary. And the use of the brackets there is intentional. When you are reading a quote, if the author who didn't write that quote needs to clarify the quote, they'll put it in brackets to say, hey, the original author didn't say this, but this is kind of the context of what's going on. Because when you pull a quote out of a page, sometimes things get lost in translation, and so they clarify with brackets, right? So they clarify the context of what is happening. It provides clarity to an existing sentence. And so here's what I mean when I say extraordinary, and that's this, that God takes your ordinary and makes it extraordinary. God takes your ordinary and makes it extraordinary. Our text for today is Ruth chapter 1, and we're just going to be looking at the first 5 verses. Now, because this is a story, I'm going to do my best not to give you spoilers today. Not too many anyways, if I can help it. The thing about a good story is that we like to know how it finishes. Sometimes we like to jump to the end and know what's going to happen and how it's all going to play out. But if you are too quick, if you rush to the end of the story, you will miss all of the lessons along the way. You will miss the meaning in the mundane. And so we're gonna read these first 5 verses, and you know, I'll kind of give you some hints at how the direction of the story is going to go, but I'm not going to give you any spoilers. So here we go. Ruth chapter 1, the first 5 verses. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and 2 sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her 2 sons. The 2 sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and another a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her 2 sons or her husband. There's a surprising amount of lessons in those first few verses. And the first lesson that we can learn from this text is that God is at work in the ordinary. God is at work in the ordinary. See, this book opens with a quiet but stark contrast. It says, in the days when the judges ruled Israel. Now, that may not mean anything to you, and that's okay, but it meant a great deal to its original readers. It's to the Israelites. You see, the time of the judges, which you can read about, by the way, it's the book right before Ruth. In the time of the judges, they were tumultuous, to say the least. They were times of wars and conflict and rebellion. And it was not a great time to be around. It was a time full of lots and lots of conflict. And the term judges didn't refer to someone like a judge today who would sit and decide what was right and wrong. Instead, the time of judges was before there was a king in Israel. And so when Israel was being oppressed, God would raise up a specific leader for a specific time and a specific purpose to set the people of Israel free. And so God would raise up judges to lead Israel into war or to assassinate another king, all kinds of interesting things. God would raise up judges to help free his people. And the verse that most clearly explains what this era in Israel's history was like is found in Judges 21:25. In those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. Sounds like a great time. Not really. By contrast, Ruth seems to take place during a short period of rest during the judges. There's an Old Testament scholar by the name of Victor P. Hamilton, and he writes this. He says, "The pastoral calmness of Ruth contrasts vividly with the chaos and turbulence of Judges. Judges focuses on times of wars and conquests and liberation. Ruth focuses on times of peace, the kind of family events that take place during years of rest in the land." You see, the drastic contrast here, while maybe is missed by us, would not have been missed by its original audience. The next thing that the author does is he introduces us to some characters, the people in the story. So who is this family that we learn about? Who are these people? What is their legacy? Well, we're introduced to a family with a father by the name of Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And we're told that they live in Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem was a small town. You kind of picture the place where everyone knows everyone. You know, it's kind of like Ladysmith, right? You go somewhere and you know someone. It was a small town. And we're also told that they were Ephrathites. Now, Ephrath was an earlier name for the town of Bethlehem. And so the reason that the author points this out is probably to say, hey, this is a family that grew up. This is a family that has deep roots in Bethlehem. This is a family that history goes way back. You know, I'm a bot, and there's not a lot of bots in BC. There's a couple of us sort of spattered around. But if you go to the hometown where I grew up, you can throw a stick in any direction, and you'll hit a bot or someone who's married to a bot or related to a bot. Like, when I would go around and people would be talking to me, they'd be like, "You're Sterling's boy, aren't you?" Right? I wasn't Joe. I was Sterling's boy. Like, we were just known, right? Right? Bots were everywhere. So that's kind of the same thing that the author is getting at here, is they were a well-established, well-respected family in the small town that they grew up in. Now, there's a twist, a little bit of a plot twist in the story. A famine happens, and they're forced to leave Bethlehem, and they go to Moab. Now, this isn't anything unusual. The land of Palestine, especially in those times, had very uncertain rainfall. And so droughts and famines were very common. And a natural response to that was to get up, temporarily leave that region or that country, depending on how widespread the famine was, and then you would go and live somewhere else temporarily, wait for the whole thing to blow over, and then come back. And so that's what Elimelech does. He moves with his family temporary to Moab. But it turns out that in the 10 years that they're there, he dies and his two sons die. And before his sons die, they marry Orpah and Ruth, and they're Moabite women. Now, this is another subtle thing that our author very quietly brings in, okay? He goes out of the way just enough to make sure that we know that they married Moabite women. And now, this is again, extremely important. Moab in Israel had a very a very strong conflict during this time. Not necessarily during this exact time, but during the book of Judges, Moab and Israel are in constant conflict throughout that time. Before the book of Judges, early in Israel's history as a nation, Moab ensnared Israel into sinning against God and deceived them. And so, in Deuteronomy 23:3, Israel is warned against marrying a Moabite woman. And while it wasn't forbidden at this time, it was certainly not encouraged. It certainly wasn't the type of relationship that you would want to say, like, hey, guess what? I'm marrying a Moabite woman. That was not something that mom was happy to hear, okay? They were outsiders. They had a history of deceiving and oppressing the nation of Israel. But more than that, Israel had the God-given responsibility to remain clean and holy. And throughout the Judges, one of the problems that they had is that they would go and marry someone from outside of the nation of Israel, and they would bring their religion with them, and then the whole nation of Israel would start following that religion, and they would away from God. These first five verses end with Elimelech and his two sons dying, leaving Naomi and her two outsider daughter-in-laws completely alone. So what is the point of all this, right? What does this have to do with our lives today? The point is that for some reason, God chose these ordinary people to be included in his redemptive story. For some reason, God chose these ordinary people to be in part of his grand saving story about how he's making all things new. You know, nowhere in this book does God call them to greatness. Instead, he calls them to live lives of significance. And don't miss this. This is so often where we go wrong. We confuse greatness with significance. I'm going to say that again. Don't confuse greatness with significance. Right? Ruth didn't lead the nation of Israel into victory like the judge Deborah did. She didn't save the nation from impending genocide like Queen Esther would do in the future. Right? But she lived a life of significance and meaning, of such value that it is worthy of being included in the biblical text. Right? Her life is so integral to the unfolding story of God's redemption that it was included in both the Hebrew scriptures and now in our Bible. And what this means to us is that God is at work in your ordinary, in the mundane moments of everyday life. God is working. You know, maybe he isn't moving physical mountains or making your wildest dreams come true or solving all of your problems, but he is there. And for the willing and the obedient, for those who have a heart that want to serve him, he will accomplish his purposes. God does not overlook or devalue the ordinary. He makes it extraordinary. So if you get discouraged, if you feel overwhelmingly normal, I want you to be encouraged that God wants to journey with you step by step towards a life of significance. After all, isn't this what Jesus himself told us? He said, if you lay down your life, if you give up your life, that is when you will find it. When you follow me, when you follow Jesus, that is the true path to significance. Not pursuing our own greatness, not pursuing our own kingdom, our own platform, but pursuing God's greatness and his love. So that's the first lesson. The second lesson is God is at work in your tragedy. God is at work in your tragedy. See, the book of Ruth doesn't just start out with a humble beginning, it starts out with a tragic beginning. Naomi's husband dies, followed by her two sons. Now, in ancient Near Eastern history, names had a lot of significance. Okay, they carried with them a lot of meaning. And in tragic irony, the name Mahlon means to be sickly, and Chilion means failing or pining. But the lesson to be learned is actually found in Elimelech's name. Elimelech's name means "My God is King." And the reason that this is significant, to borrow again from Victor P. Hamilton, he says this. He says, "Can one still affirm that my God is king when my God is king is dead? And the surviving spouse is a refugee, an alien, and a woman." Now, I want you to understand something here. He's not being derogatory or sexist about Naomi being a woman. You need to understand that in that time and in that culture, being a woman without a husband or without sons was a great tragedy, and it was for two major reasons. On one level, it meant it was the end of the family line. That was the end of Elimelech's family line. And in a culture where you get so much identity and there's so much meaning in where you came from and the longevity of your family, it was a grief worth grieving. It wasn't just the loss of her husband and her son, it was the death of a family. So that's on one level. On the second level, very practically, Naomi was now destined for a life of poverty. Whatever wealth or status she may have had was left in Bethlehem. Losing your husband and your sons meant that she had absolutely no security, that there was no way for her to earn a living. There was no one to look after her in her old age. Everything that she had been stripped from her, and all that she had left were her two daughter-in-laws, who would be considered as outsiders. In the same way, sometimes life hands us more than we can handle, doesn't it? Grief too heavy to bear, anxiety and depression that can cripple, tragedy strikes in a moment and your financial security is lost, right? You've put your hope in God for your whole life and your children don't seem to be following him. They seem to be turning away and it breaks your heart and it's truly tragic. And how in those moments can you continue to proclaim, let alone believe, my God is king? How can we proclaim, my God is king, when tragedy strikes? We can feel like the psalmist felt, who cries out in desperation to God. He says, can those in the grave declare your unfailing love? Can they proclaim your faithfulness in the place of destruction? Can the darkness speak of your wonderful deeds? Can anyone in the land of forgetfulness talk about your righteousness? O Lord, I cry out to you. I will keep pleading day by day. Oh Lord, why do you reject me? Why do you turn your face from me? Have you ever been there? Have you ever had a crisis of faith or felt like God had rejected you or abandoned you? If you have, here is the good news. Naomi's story isn't over yet, and neither is yours. See, without giving you any spoilers, I'll just say this, that God walks with Naomi in her darkest hours, and he walks with you in yours. In Romans 8, the Apostle Paul affirms God's unfailing love towards us. He writes this, he says, can anything ever separate us from Christ's love? Does it mean he no longer loves us if we have trouble or calamity or are persecuted or are hungry or destitute or in danger or threatened with death? As the scriptures say, for your sake, we are killed every day. We are being slaughtered like sheep. No, despite all these things, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ who loved us. See, nothing, absolutely nothing, can separate us from the love of Jesus. Even in our darkest hour, God is with us. Even in the darkest dark, it will give way to his light and his joy and his freedom. So why don't I just jump to the end? Why don't I just tell you how Naomi's story ends and say, look, this is how God pieced her story together and made it beautiful? Because when we endure suffering, we don't know how the story ends. When you are in the midst of suffering, when you are in the midst of some kind of conflict, you don't know how it's going to end. And the last thing in the world that you need is someone who's going to come alongside you and jump right to the end and say, hey, don't worry, God works all things together for good, brother. You got this. I know your wife just left you, but just hang in there. Right? We need someone to be with us. We need a ministry of presence. We need what Naomi needed was someone to walk alongside her and to be with her. She was completely isolated and alone, and she needed a ministry of presence, someone to be with her in her suffering. And isn't that what we all need in times of suffering? And at times when we need more than anything the tangible presence of God. It's like, God, I know you're with me, but I would love to feel you, to see you, to touch you. You know what he does? He sends his church. He says, yes, I'll send you my tangible presence. Here's my church. So are you suffering right now? If you are, I want you to know that God is not finished your story yet. God doesn't step off his throne when we can't feel his presence. My God is king even when we can't see it. Don't be too quick to rush to the end of the story or you'll miss what he is trying to teach you along the way. And maybe you're here and you're not suffering. And you're like, Joe, I come to church and I feel like all you ever talk about is suffering. But I'm doing good. Well, that's awesome. That is something worth celebrating. I want all of you to know, if you are here and you're like, you're preaching about suffering, but my life is great, praise God. That is an amazing thing. That's worth praising God for. But here's what my question for you. If you're here and life is good, my question is, who can you suffer with? Whose journey can you be a part of? How can you alleviate the suffering of those around you? See, after all, isn't that what Jesus did? Isn't that what we're called to? Jesus, he took our pain and our suffering and our shame and he bore it on himself on the cross. And we may not be Jesus, but we can come alongside people and say, hey, let me carry the load. Let me be here and walk with you step by step through your suffering. The third lesson that we can learn is that God is at work in you. God is at work in you. See, in the grand story of the Bible, we find the quiet book of Ruth. Unassuming, but it plays a vital role in the story. Its very existence in the biblical text teaches us something truly profound, and that is this, that God has not overlooked you. God has not overlooked you. You see, if your story doesn't play out like a blockbuster movie or like an Academy Award winning drama, it doesn't mean that your story isn't worth being told, that it isn't being worth written, that it is. Right? See, the book of Ruth concerns itself with the everyday things that concern us, the everyday things that worry us. It talks about, throughout the book, it talks about tragedy and grief, the stress of moving, being an alien and returning home, the concerns of work and poverty, obligation, kindness, faithfulness, friendship, family, and duty, all of the kinds of things that worry us, concern us day to day. And sometimes we think that God is so big and our lives so small and insignificant and unimportant that God doesn't want to be involved in them. But Ruth teaches us the exact opposite. It's actually God who cares so much and so much about your life. God actually cares about who you marry. God cares if you're in grief. God cares if you act nobly in a situation that is difficult. God is concerned about the everyday things that concern us. The everyday concerns of people are also the concerns of our loving Heavenly Father. He cares about you, even in times when it seems like no one else does. But here's the beautiful thing. Suddenly, invisible if you're unattentive to it, God is at work behind the scenes, transforming the lives of Ruth and Naomi. And in the same way, so much of our lives, God is working, even when we can't see it, like that song that we said. Even when I can't see it, you're working. In the mundane and the ordinary, God is orchestrating and moving things around. And for those whose heart longs for God and want to serve him, God will orchestrate and move your lives around to achieve his purposes and his will. And so I want you to know this morning, if this is for you, God has not forgotten you. Even when you can't see him, he is working. And if you let him, he will transform you step by step until your ordinary becomes extraordinary. I'm going to ask the band to come on up. You know, preachers have said for a long time that Jesus would have went to the cross even if you had been the only one. And I believe that with all my heart, that even if you had been the only one, Jesus would have gone to the cross. See, friends, Jesus died on the cross and he rose again for all of humanity. From the greatest down to the least. For those who follow the path to significance and those who waste their lives away. He took our suffering. He took our sin, our wrongdoings, our shame, our pain, even our sickness on His shoulders. And He carried them so we wouldn't have to. He carried them so that we could experience life and have life to the full, that we could walk in a new way to be human, that we could be in the presence of our God and King. He bore the ultimate suffering so that we wouldn't have to. Would He have done that if you were insignificant? If you were a nobody? See, it's not that we were deserving. In fact, far from it, the Bible actually tells us that before we were saved, that we were actually enemies of God, actively opposing Him. So it wasn't that we deserved His love. It wasn't that we had earned His love. It wasn't that there was anything particularly special about us. But it's because of His goodness and His greatness that gives us significance. It's His love, His faithfulness, His sacrifice that gives us meaning. See, the gospel works best for the poor and the lonely and the broken. It works best for the ordinary and the overlooked, because we aren't looking to find our value or our self-worth in some petty human achievement. By being the best or the greatest, your identity is found in being a child of God. And when you find your identity as a child of God, God takes your ordinary and He makes it extraordinary.